I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're at the end of an especially wild week in Washington, where it was seemingly all about President Trump all the time. Like him or not, Trump's the kind of president who attracts constant attention, and that made us want to look back at one of Trump's predecessors in the Oval Office, a more understated leader, that's for sure. Harry S. Truman was perhaps one of the most influential and underrated presidents of the 20th century. He oversaw the end of World War II and rose to the challenge of the Cold War, and he was crucial to the creation of international organizations like the United Nations and NATO that aim to unite countries. But for many people, Truman is remembered for really one thing, his decision to drop nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan in August of 1945. His grandson, Clifton Truman Daniel, is now an advocate against nuclear weapons, and he joins us from the studios of our friends over at WBEZ in Chicago. So, Clifton, thanks for being with us. Where exactly do you stand on nuclear weapons today?
Well, that seems to beg a simple answer. I'm against them. That's it.
And being against them, how does that make you feel about your grandfather's decision to bomb?
Grandfather, yeah, he made that decision. He always said it. He never changed what he said or wrote about it. He made the decision to shorten the war and save American lives primarily, as well as Japanese lives, had the war gone on, had there been a full-scale invasion. The scholarship on that goes back and forth, but Grandpa, having made the decision, nonetheless felt horrible about the destruction, about the loss of life. There was a White House photographer named Joe O'Donnell who took, when he was in the military at the end of the war, took some of the earliest images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombings. And O'Donnell wound up on the beach on Wake Island with my grandfather. This is when Grandpa went to meet General MacArthur in 1950. And they were alone on the beach, O'Donnell and my grandfather, and O'Donnell just took a chance and asked my grandfather, did you ever have any regrets using those weapons? And my grandfather said, hell yes. He didn't want to have to do that.
Talk a bit about when you really started to reflect on all this. Like, how old were you? Do you remember, like, the conversation you had with your grandfather, Harry Truman, where the bombings of these Japanese cities became really real?
No, he never spoke to me about the atomic bombings. I learned about them like everybody else in history class and from my books. And the books didn't tell me much. There's a page or two. There's maybe a picture of the mushroom cloud, a picture of the empty streets of Hiroshima, but it doesn't really tell you about – you get casualty figures, but it doesn't really tell you what happened on the ground. I didn't understand that until I was in my 30s, 40s actually. My son Wesley – Wes is 28 now. He was 10 years old. He was in school here in Chicago in fifth grade, and he came home with a book, Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes. It's the fictionalized account of a true story, a little girl named Sadako Sasaki. She was 2 years old when the bomb destroyed Hiroshima. And she and her family escaped pretty much unharmed. They were lucky. But 9 years later, Sadako was diagnosed with radiation-induced leukemia. And in an effort to save her own life, she followed a Japanese tradition that says if you fold 1,000 origami paper cranes, you are granted a wish or long life or health. Sadako folded probably 1,300 cranes while she was in the hospital. And unfortunately, it did not help. She died of the leukemia in 1955. There is a statue to her and to all of the children killed, wounded, sickened by the bomb in the Hiroshima Peace Park today. That was the first human story I had ever seen of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And I remember telling Wesley at the time that it was important that he understand both sides, that it was important to understand his great-grandfather's decision, his country's point of view, but also to understand what that decision cost the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mentioned reading that book to a Japanese journalist sometime after that, and the story was read in Japan, and I had a phone call one day from Masahiro Sasaki, Sadako Sasaki's older brother, himself a survivor of Hiroshima. And he just said, nice to talk to you. Can we get together someday? Would you consider coming to Japan? Mm-hmm. And I said yes to all of that.
Had you been
to
Japan
before
that?
I had never been. Yeah. No. We finally met in New York in 2010 at the 9/11 Tribute Center, where Masahiro and his son Yuji were donating one of Sadako's original coins as a gesture of healing. And at the end of our meeting, Yuji Sasaki took out a small plastic box and dropped a tiny paper crane into my palm and said, "That's the last one Sadako folded before she died. Would you come to the ceremonies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?"
Wow.
And I said yes. And my family and I went in 2012 to both ceremonies and sat down and talked to more than two dozen survivors.
Yeah, what
so
was that
it was really
like?
Then that I... It's hard to explain. It's hard to describe. It's, you know, I want to say it's heart-wrenching. It's hard. It's horrible to hear these stories. But as hard as it is for the listener, it's harder still for the survivor who relives that day over and over and over again, solely in an effort to let the listener know what it was like so that we don't do it again.
As the grandson of the president who made that decision, did you feel like any residual guilt meeting these people?
No. Guilt, no. Responsibility, yes. And not responsibility for the bombings, but responsibility to do what I could to help ensure that it doesn't happen again. All the survivors asked me in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were to please help them tell their stories, continue to help them tell the stories. So I've tried to do that.
I know you've become acquainted with a number of descendants of various world leaders, including a member of the Japanese imperial family. How did you meet them? Who are they? And given how your respective ancestors were involved historically, was it difficult to relate to them, or maybe easier in some way?
No. And the one you're talking about, not a member of the imperial family, but the great-grandson of wartime Prime Minister Tojo, this Hidetoshi Tojo. And Hidetoshi and I have never met face-to-face. We were both on an Australian public television show called Insight a couple of years ago. They did a two-part show called Bloodlines, the first part being on the European theater of World War II and the second part being on the Pacific theater. And I was in the studio here in Chicago, and Hidetoshi was in Australia. And the show also included the great-grandson of Joseph Stalin and the son of Hans Frank, who was the governor general of occupied Poland during the war, responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of Jews. And Hidetoshi, when it came time for our interview, listening to him, he was doing sort of the same thing I was. He was trying to reconcile. He was trying to find the middle ground in talking about the war. And afterward, we struck up an email correspondence, and the two of us have been talking to each other on and off for a couple of years.
Tojo was hanged after an international trial after the war, correct?
He was.
Did that come up with Hidetoshi?
Yes, yes. He said two things about that. One, he thought it was proper and honorable for his grandfather to take responsibility for the conduct of the war, but he didn't think that his great-grandfather should have been hanged.
What do you remember of your grandfather, Harry Truman?
The earliest memory was when we were very young. He came to visit us in New York. I grew up in Manhattan. And Grandpa, Gammy and Grandpa would stay down the street at the Carlisle Hotel. And Grandpa got up every morning, went for a one-mile walk at a military pace, 120 steps a minute. Always said that anything more than a mile walk didn't do a man over 40 any good. Mm. So he'd go for a mile walk, come back, eat a quick breakfast, grab as many newspapers as he could get his hands on, and cart them up to our apartment, let himself in with the spare key, and throw the whole mess on the floor and read until somebody woke up.
Wow.
And my brother Will and I were the first ones down one morning, and we saw Grandpa in the living room. He was behind the newspaper, so he didn't see us. And we started to tiptoe past him to get into the den to turn on the television set and watch cartoons. And he caught us. He said, "Where do you think you're going?" And I said, "Into the den to watch Bugs Bunny." He said, "You don't want to do that." And I was probably thinking, yes, I do. And he walked between us, and he went into the den. He took a book down from the top shelf, and he came back out, and he said, "You come here and sit down with me." And we didn't argue with him. It was fruitless anyway. So we sat down, and he opened the book and started to read. And my mother came down probably 15 minutes later and stopped cold at the bottom of the steps. We were sitting on either side of Grandpa, stock still, silent, while he read to us from a book that didn't have any pictures in it. And she said, "What are you reading to those kids?" And he showed her the spine of the book. It was Thucydides, History of the Peloponnesian War, at 6 o'clock in the morning to a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. I took that book down some years later when I was in my late 30s or early 40s. I got a glass of wine, and I sat down in the living room with that book, thought, you know, if he wanted me to read it when I was 4, I should probably try when I was 40. I got 2 pages into it and shut the book and finished the wine. It was tough stuff.
When he took that walk in Central Park, did he have Secret Service in the shadow? Or
Not until 1965. I mean, well, early 64, after JFK was assassinated.
Just one last thing I want to ask you, Clifton, if I could.
Yeah.
With the Trump White House, we see this kind of tension between nepotism and legacy. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about that.
You know, it's a mixed bag for me. My grandfather, when he was a senator, had my grandmother on the payroll, and she was answering mail and doing secretarial stuff, and he caught flack for that.
Hmm.
You know, to bring your kids and your son-in-law in close to the White House as advisors when they've had no experience in government, no experience in world affairs, is a little bizarre. That said, if Ivanka Trump particularly has a calming and rationalizing influence on her father, great. So again, mixed bag. It's legacy is the one thing that struck me a little while ago about President Trump was the whole brouhaha over his comments about Andrew Jackson and the Civil War, which of course Jackson didn't live to see. And it, you know, that he doesn't know the history. My grandfather loved history. He was the last president we had who did not have a college degree, never even went to college. But he read constantly, and almost all of it was history, was biography, autobiography. So the presidency and the country come with them a rich history, and you need to know it to be able to take us forward. Like Grandpa said, there's nothing new in the world but the history you don't know. And so that bothers me that President Trump doesn't seem to be paying attention to the legacy.
Clifton Truman Daniel, the eldest grandchild of President Harry S. Truman, thank you very much for being with us today. Great to speak with
you.
You're
welcome. Thank you, Marco.